start. Good afternoon. It is the 20th. Oh, here comes our chairman. Okay, good. We have to be going. We have to be finished by 1:45, otherwise we're going to lose.
We're going to be finished by 1:30 on this bill, I think.
Yes.
I guess the meeting has been called to order with Mr. Gruenberg, Martin, Gall, and Ellis in attendance. Mr. Swackhammer is before us. House Bill 368 is the subject. Yeah. Representative?
Mr. Chairman, if I could take a little latitude.
Speak
I think
freely,
that,
please.
I think that you'll notice that I have not appeared before this committee this year, and I'd like to note that it probably was by design. But a lot of times in my prior life, you know, we had a lot of frustrations, and we had to deal with what we would call anger management. And to that end, I'd like to make a gift to the committee. And this is called your attorney says see you in court.
Absolutely.
And every time that you seem to have a problem, they pinpoint its severity. If it's just a small problem, you just shake. If you're a little bit more mad, you just jerk off the leg. And if you're really mad at him, you just take off the leg. And this is my commitment. Incidentally, I don't know who that resembles at all. But, Tyler would like to have that when he's done with it.
Representative, is the house there in the hand of
the house and the screwdriver, you can just make your own analogy.
There is a close resemblance.
Oh, I hadn't noticed.
No. I don't know that we want to draw conclusions on the record about the screwdriver of the house, though.
Well, how about the resemblance?
No, I don't think so. But, Mr. Swackhammer, I need to ask you for purposes of the record, we were thinking of making anger a proscribed activity under our schedule of prohibited social actions, and so I think possibly by taking direct steps to criminalize anger in the state, we may be able to return this to the proper recipient.
If it belongs to Tyler.
That's what I mean, to Tyler. Can we keep it for a little
yes,
while just to
through the session
till we get our bill through
the session?
Okay,
we'll give it back at the close of your bill today.
You probably would like to keep it here, otherwise you're liable to see it again.
Okay, well, Mr. Miller has joined us, drawn in no doubt by the good vibes and positive atmosphere.
This is a detachable guy.
In case you get upset, Mike, just rip the head off.
Okay. Okay. See you in court.
Okay.
Just see you in court.
Well, Mr. Swackhammer, I believe that you and Mr. Gruenberg have conferred regarding some of the technicalities that were a concern in the Judiciary Committee regarding House Bill 368. If you'd care to suggest amendments, I think you'd find the committee quite responsive to your needs.
Mr. Chairman, just for the purposes of discussion, if I may, just that we have two amendments and they should be labeled 1 and 2.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Gruenberg. I regret that I don't have either of them.
That's Amendment 2.
I have Amendment 2.
The unnumbered amendment is Amendment 2. Amendment 1 is at the bottom, the very bottom of everything.
Yeah, I see.
There's Amendment number 1 there.
I'd like to respectfully instruct committee staff to put the bills on the top of the piles and the amendments right under the bills. Okay? The bills on the top of the pile, amendments right under the bills. Thank you. Mr. Swackhammer, you have the floor.
Yes, under Amendment number 1, Mr. Chairman, after reading this bill, technically we wanted to ensure that the inspection process as laid out by this bill does not apply to the non-conforming loans, which is 1856-106. And there were, I believe, 15 loans in 89 for the non-conforming loans. They don't have a number for 1990. But there would be a lot of problems in applying this particular statute to non-conforming loans, and so we would ask for that exemption.
Quite right. Speaking as a representative from rural Alaska, I think that this will be very much appreciated by the people who have to address the requirements of this bill. I thank you, and I would like to get a motion on amendment number 1, please.
So
Mr. Gruenberg moves amendment number one. Are there any objections or discussion? Hearing none, amendment number one is adopted. Mr. Swackhammer.
Mr. Chairman, amendment number two is a compromise reached by Representative Gruenberg and myself. The intent that we had with the liability exemption for the inspectors and for the corporation was because of a new requirement to meet a building code, we did not want to incur further liability or to have a cost that would be forwarded on a further cost to the consumer. And Representative Gruenberg's what we reached was a standard of gross negligence or intentional misconduct by anyone on the that's performing these, and this is acceptable to the inspectors, because what we don't want to protect is someone that signs off on an inspection and doesn't perform the task, or if there is intentional misconduct and where he has a vendetta against a particular contractor. So that is the intent.
I find your testimony very disarming, Mr. Swackhammer. Mr. Gruenberg? Okay. The amendment technically has a misplaced modifier, and it should read as follows. A person may not bring an action for damages based on a duty created under B of this section to inspect a residential unit, dot, 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 etc. The unit wasn't created under B of this section. It's the duty that was created under B of this section.
Right. Yeah. So, Mr. Gruenberg, if I may, I'd like to read the amendment as corrected. I don't think we need to make this an amendment to the amendment since we haven't moved the amendment. We'll just correct the language, and for purposes of the record and committee staff will note, it will read, C, a person may not bring an action for damages based on a duty created under this section.
Under B of this section.
May not bring an action for damages based on a duty created under B of this section to inspect a residential unit unless the action is for damages caused by gross negligence or intentional misconduct. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. And I would like, for the purposes of discussion, to move the amendment and then discuss it briefly.
Amendment has been moved by Mr. Gruenberg. Discussion, Mr. Gruenberg?
Yeah, if the members will look at the Busby Act, which is Chapter 68 that's in here, we use the identical language. And everybody around here, I believe, hopefully will remember our lengthy discussion of how we crafted that language very carefully. And that was based on the case of Levitt versus Gillespie, I believe, which defines gross negligence. And once again, that Levitt versus Gillespie is L-E-A-V-I-T-T versus Gillespie, G-I-L-L-A-S-P-I-E, and it's at 443 Pacific 2nd, 61 in Alaska, 1968 case in the Supreme Court. And that definition of gross negligence is, the evidence must show that the person had full knowledge of the hazards he was creating by his actions, such as to evidence reckless disregard of the possible consequence and indifference to the rights of others. And there must be facts which would lead a reasonable person to conclude that the actor's conduct under these circumstances not only creates an unreasonable risk of harm to the other person, but also involves a high degree of probability that such harm will result. And gross negligence differs from ordinary negligence in that ordinary negligence consists of mere inadvertence, incompetence, unskillfulness, or failure to take precautions, while gross negligence requires a conscious choice of a cause of action with the knowledge that it contains the risk of harm to others. And that was the identical standard for Busby. And once again, this higher standard only insulates here the duties that are created under this section. It doesn't insulate somebody who, like a contractor, would have otherwise had the duty to inspect, or an architect who may have otherwise had the duty to inspect. We're not increasing any existing duty standard. We're simply saying for any new standard that's created here, it's going to be gross negligence.
Well, Mr. Gruenberg, I think that was quite a feat
And I think we can move ahead now. Can we get a motion? Oh, no. Are there any objections to the amendment?
I'd just like to say that I believe that both sides have agreed on this compromise.
All parties seem to support it in the House. A motion has been made. Any objections to the amendment? Hearing none, amendment number two is adopted. Mr. Martin?
Just one question on the committee, proposed substitute. And I think this was in the...
May I explain what the CS is, Mr. Martin? Just so you know.
Well, forget the one that you have, 227.90.
Mr. Martin, excuse me. The CS is not before us. We have made two amendments to the bill that came in. That CS is not before us unless you wish to bring it before us.
Oh, so yeah, the packet.
May I explain?
Mr. Grunberg?
Yeah. The CS contained only amendment number two. And that amendment number two is on page three. And it's incorrect because we've since done the modifier properly.
Because we're short of time, let me repeat. The CS is not before us. Can we get a motion on the bill, please?
I'm on the bill. Discussion.
Discussion on the bill. Mr. Martin.
Okay. In the last section three, page two, line 26, the same concern I have. Why don't we delay this to 1991? Why not 1990?
Mr. Swackhammer?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman,
18 months.
There is... what we did is we did not want to create more government employees. And what we're doing is we're allowing the private sector to develop enough inspectors through the International Conference of Building Officials. Mm-hmm. In the 18 months, we give them enough time to ensure that they can provide the training and certification on a statewide regional basis. There are several in Anchorage and some in Fairbanks, but we wanted to give enough lag time so that there is adequate people to be able to do this inspection.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Grunberg?
With that, there's no other objection. I move that the two amendments be incorporated into a new CS.
The drafters, when they move the bill to the next committee, will incorporate our two amendments. When the drafters move our bill to the Rules Committee, they will incorporate our two amendments in a Judiciary Committee substitute. Can we get a motion to move the bill, please?
I move the bill. Are
there any objections? Hearing none, House Bill 268, amended in the House Judiciary Committee, which will be turned into a Judiciary CS by the drafters, mm-hmm. is moved from committee with individual recommendations. Thank you, Mr. Schleckman.
Thank you.
This brings us to the main issue before us today, the Commission on Judicial Conduct. Those persons who are here to speak on that bill, please indicate that they are here. Thank you. Would you come join us at the table, please?
We got called on.
I have advised Mr. Donnelly that this hearing would take place, and I do suggest that somebody call him, please.
Mark, why don't you call
him? I'd like to avoid a floor debate on this bill. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I'm Jan Strandberg with the court system here on behalf of the Supreme Court.
Thank you, Mr. Amberg. I think it's going to be essential that all members of the House State Affairs Committee be fully briefed on what occurs here. There has been a great deal of misunderstanding about what we can do and what we cannot do, and we definitely need to get that extraordinarily clearly clarified on the record. But in addition to that, if we are to avoid problems down the road, it's very important that the folks who brought us this State Affairs CS truly understand the changes that are being made and the reasons why we have no choice but to make those changes. So that is just a request from the chair to you, and I appreciate your assistance in that matter. Forgive me for being unsure here, but if I'm not mistaken, Max, were you taking us through this CS last time when we had to adjourn section by section? No, we were up to the State Affairs version, knowing just what happened there, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we completed State Affairs.
Okay.
Let's
do that. What we have before us at the moment, what we have had is an explanation of the changes between the original bill and the State Affairs Committee substitute. Thank you for reminding me, Terry. The essential change that occurred in State Affairs was the opening up of the process more than the original bill had opened it up. Mr. Martin, I believe, do we have, who, Carla Forsyth is on the line now?
Marla.
Marla Greenstein is on the line now.
Yes, I am.
Marla, thank you. Could you just, in just three or four sentences, to bring the committee back up to date, summarize just very briefly anything that I left out in describing the differences between state affairs and the original bill, and then Mr. Martin has a question.
Okay, I wasn't sure that I'm aware of Mr. Martin's question, but basically you're correct in the summary that the State Affairs Committee substitute opens the procedures up more than the original bill does, and it opens it up to the extent that it would interfere with the Commission's ability to informally and privately handle minor things against judges that currently the Commission has the power to do.
And what is the constitutional justification that you feel prevents this committee from allowing those changes to remain in the bill?
There, I don't know for sure that there's a constitutional problem with that aspect of the bill, but it interferes. What it would do is basically take away from the Commission its power to informally address concerns. That informal power is not specifically granted by the Constitution, it's granted by the current statute that's in play.
Well, then, the argument that we must make these changes is not a valid argument. Is that correct? We have the discretion to do so or not, and we need to listen to arguments as to whether or not it is bad public policy, but there's no constitutional issue here?
I wouldn't go so far as to say there's no constitutional argument. The constitutional argument might be that this is an appropriate judicial branch function that is implicit in the constitutional provision that grants the Commission the authority to investigate complaints against judges, but I don't think it's clear on its face. I think that it might be open to that. The main point that I wanted to make, though, is that the Commission does use this informal process frequently, and that what the Commission would most likely end up doing is if it didn't have the power to informally address minor concerns, probably just wouldn't address them, and that's the concern that I would raise.
Well, of course, we could pass a statute that would take away that discretion and make sure that you address them, and make sure that you make them public, and make sure that if your finding is that informal or mild sanctions or counseling are necessary, that be made public. Why not?
Oh, I think that's possible. I'm just raising the point that I'm not sure that it's good public policy. It's certainly not prohibited. Yesterday you did request that I put together a list of some brief examples of the types of things that the Commission does currently handle informally that aren't made public, and I did do that, and just briefly summarize those that might help in illustrating why it probably would not be good public policy to adopt those changes. The types of things that the Commission addresses informally that go to recommendations for counseling are temporary physical illness, temporary personal situations, for example, family problems that judges are involved in, temporary mental illness, lack of interpersonal skills on the part of a judge, and the need for a judge to acquire education in certain specific areas of the law or procedure. Those are things that end up going to recommendations for counseling. Obviously, there are privacy concerns of the judge that into play in those. The others that are handled through informal admonishments, as I mentioned yesterday, are those things that single instances by themselves do not, by the case law, constitute misconduct. These are things that require a pattern or practice before they're considered misconduct. So when the Commission is faced with a single instance of the following, they can and do offer informal admonishments, which consist of warnings to the judge that if this happens again, it will rise to the level of going through formally. And those are single instances of falling asleep on the bench, a single instance of delay in ruling on a case or motion, a single instance of ex parte contact, that is, where a judge speaks to one party without the other being present, a single instance of inappropriate language in or out of court, a single instance of lack of control over the courtroom, a single instance of inappropriate behavior in a social setting, and a single instance of giving legal advice.
Well, some of those seem trivial, some of them don't. It's an interesting issue. Mr. Martin, I think we're ready now for you, sir.
Yeah, thank you. I'm mainly concerned about the words that we use, informal and minor incidents and minor allegations and complaints. But when I read the bill, I see other words being used, and I want to be sure that I'm not misinterpreting as I conceive it. Number one, the major question is, why should a judge be treated any different than any other person of the government or bureaucracy or whatever it may be, and even politicians? But I wouldn't put them to that particular judgment by the citizen, because we're elected by them, and in this case the judges aren't. But on line, page 1, line 11, here we're talking about allegations that a judge, and blank, 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 and then you go into the three major things. Allegation that he has been convicted of a crime punishable as a felony. To me, that's not a minor thing. I think that the people should know that this person who is our judge had been convicted. And at what time we're taking an allegation that he's been convicted? Shouldn't we say something stronger? Either he's been convicted or he hasn't been convicted. The allegation, it throws me off. Same way on page 2, line 4 and 5, we're talking again about an allegation. The commission may exonerate the judge informally or privately. I don't feel that this should be done privately. I think that for the judge's sake and for the public's sake, that if he's been exonerated against a false charge, it should be blasted over the speakers. The people should know that there's no camouflaging the quality of this particular judge. So I guess I'm really saying, why should we have a different... quality of sanctioning judge privately or publicly than we would of any other public official. Why protect judges, for instance, against felonies if he or she has been convicted of it?
I can let me address the specific one first. The allegation of the conviction, I agree with you, the inappropriate wording, but it was in the original draft of the original bill that's currently on the books as law. Convictions obviously are public record. So the conviction of a felony is a public record right now, and there should be no reason why that isn't public information in and of itself. I think that was just in the drafting, and it's more appropriate to the things that follow than for the crime. I can't see any reason why a conviction would be private. The other thing is, the informally and privately, that language that you referred to is informally and privately admonished. It doesn't go to exonerations. Exonerations can and are public. So whenever the judge requests that, his finding of no complaint or no probable cause, anytime that happens, he can request the commission to publicize that, and we do.
Okay, fine. Then why not both ways? If we're going to exonerate him, fine. And if you're going to admonish the individual, why not publicly?
Were you able to hear that?
Why not publicly admonish? Yes, I think I mentioned that there are certain instances that are minor, that are just that in and of themselves, according to the case law, the commission doesn't have the power to publicly sanction. The commission only has the power to recommend sanctions to the Supreme Court. And there are certain things that don't get to that level where the Supreme Court would issue a public admonishment. A private informal admonishment is for those things that don't rise to the level of being enough of a problem to go to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Well, that.
And then I just wanted to add a statement as far as why should judges be treated differently. I think there is really valid reason why judges are treated differently, and that is they have to preserve a degree of independence that legislators and other public officials are not required to. And for example, judges are restricted in the type of business activities they can be involved in. They're also restricted in political activities. And these are things that other public officials don't have to be as concerned about. But the reason is that judges need to live a life that's more free from inappropriate influence or the view of inappropriate influence. They have to be viewed as fair and impartial.
Well, this is Peter Gall. Whenever you mention this court case, what disturbs me about this whole discussion is the lack of a clear line of distinction between what should be kept confidential because it's so trivial that it's not important, and by making it public, you're essentially sanctioning the judge, versus what may be important, but you keep confidential because you're not allowed to sanction the judge. The examples you give, in my view, range from appropriate to inappropriate. I think if a judge is giving private counsel to one of the lawyers, I don't care if they do it once or twice, it seems like a serious matter to me. And there was another example you gave that also seemed serious, whereas if the man falls asleep one time, I mean, maybe he's ill, you know, and there's no reason to hold him up to ridicule, I suppose. I guess what concerns me, and when I've spoken to Representative Donnelly about this, I tried to use the constitutional argument.
Fine, no problem.
And then when I asked you about it, that argument, you know, dissolved. Now it's back again. I really am not sure that I'm ready to take a position on this, and I'd like to get the bill moving. So I sure hope that somebody, either yourself or Ms. Strandberg, has got some way of making it very clear, and I don't think you do. So I'm really concerned about how we're going to make this decision. I'd like to hear comments by members of the committee or by yourself or other witnesses.
I can briefly address that. Those single instances that I mentioned that fall under informal admonishment are taken from the case law of all 50 states. There is established disciplinary case law of disciplinary proceedings against judges that says that one instance of those things I listed is not enough for a legal sanction against a judge. So that comes out of the law. It's not written in statute or in court rules in any of these places, but that's how the case law has developed. And all I can say is the commission proceeds in a manner that is in accordance with law, be it case law or statute or Alaska Supreme Court decision.
So to
a certain extent, legislators, I think, or the members of the public in general, have to rely on agencies to act within the bounds of the law.
So you're saying that there is, excuse me, gentlemen, this won't work. If you want to have a conference, you have to move away from the speakerphone. If I understand what you're saying, it is then that there is a constitutional argument based on the case law that if we cross a line below which, or if we create a situation where we are admonishing the judge publicly for something that does not rise to the level of judicial inquiry, that we are de facto sanctioning the judge, and in that case violating the rules of our own constitution, and that it is that which the case law supports. Is that specifically correct? Yes or no, please.
There were two aspects of that. The second part is yes. That is true. We would be violating the current structure of the constitutional prescription and to the commission as to what it does. The first part of that, the case law I'm referring to isn't necessarily Supreme Court case law. It's not necessarily constitutional case law. The case law that I'm referring to is disciplinary commission case law. That's the cases that commissions across the country decide on the agency level. Some of that rises to the level of a constitutional decision. In other states, it doesn't. I'm just saying, in general, the law of the way these disciplinary agencies operate to find these things and help commissions determine what constitutes legal misconduct.
Okay. What I would like to do with the permission of the members is to ask Mr. Grunberg and Mr. Donnelly and yourself Ms. Strandberg to make whatever statements you feel are germane before we get into a description of the committee substitute that has been proposed by Mr. Grunberg and by yourself. I'd like to put this issue to rest. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to do anything more than form a public policy decision here, but I guess that's what we're here to do. So, Mr. Grunberg, do you wish to make a statement for the record on this subject?
This is not an easy subject, obviously, and I think that may I take the unusual step of delaying my comment until after Ms. Strandberg. First of all, what I'd like to be able to do is to, at some point, have Ms. Greenstein walk us through the proposed committee substitute.
First, let's deal with this issue. You don't need to make your statement now, but I'd like to just...
And what issue was that?
This clarification of, I think, the major issue that is going to come before us, either here or in the Rules Committee or on the floor, is to try to reach some mutual understanding with the folks who are responsible for the state affairs substitute as to drawing parameters on what is public and what is private that are truly in the public interest, recognize the Constitution and recognize the case law. It appears that both the case law and the constitutional provision allow us a certain flexibility here, albeit with the potential of challenge if we go too far in opening this process up. On the other hand, the suggestion of a lack of appropriate public scrutiny if we close it up too much. We're going to have to vote on whether or not to adopt these changes. And in order to get our bases on the record, I'd like to get each person who feels that they have an interest in this issue to make their statement so that when we get Mr. Ellison back here, we have the opportunity to vote yes or no. Therefore, maybe we should start with Ms. Strandberg, if you wish to make a statement, or Mr. Donnelly, if you wish to make a statement, and then allow Marla to come back and Mr. Grunberg, unless you wish to begin that.
Mr. Chairman,
someone has to begin.
What we did yesterday was to go through the State Affairs CS. We did not get into any proposed judiciaries.
So you'd like to compare the language and have the statements based on that? I don't want to go through the whole CS until we have finished our basic discussion on this point.
My suggestion, respectfully.
Mr. Chairman.
We heard from myself and Ms. Greenstein explaining what the changes were, but the changes were largely as the result of the good input from Representative Donnelly. We haven't heard from him.
That's
and I think maybe it would be appropriate first for Representative Donnelly to describe in a little more detail the State Affairs CS and what it does, and then we can move on from there.
That's what I'm trying to do. The State Affairs CS, though, insofar as the issues are before the committee, are dealing with the subject that we've been discussing. So for purposes of keeping the readers of the record somewhat clear on what we're doing, I'm trying to kind of keep the parameters on this subject till we dispose of it, at least in terms of getting public comment. So Dave, could you, if you differ from the statements that have been made to this committee, could you identify yourself for the record and make your position clear? And please be seated. She'll be able to hear you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to apologize. I may have to dash.
We understand, sir.
Now.
Just say your name for the record.
This is Representative Donnelly, yeah. I'm a little confused, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
I'm real curious. What I would like is an explanation. Were there any changes in State Affairs that brought this discussion of these specific cases to light?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can. What we did yesterday, Dave, was simply try to go over what the original bill did,
right,
and then factually explain the changes in State Affairs.
Right.
I was explaining them a little bit, and Marla was, and the only people who were left in the room by that time were Representative Gall and myself. So Representative Martin didn't hear that. The rest of the committee didn't hear that. If I may, Mr. Chairman, what would be helpful to us is, why don't you explain what your problems with the original bill were and what led you to do what you did in state affairs?
Let me answer Dave's question. What happened was, when we compared the two bills, the primary issue that was raised was that the informal process prior to a formal hearing, which might lead to exonerating or admonishing or recommending counseling informally and privately, was altered in state affairs such that that became a public part of the process. And it's that aspect that raised, I believe, your concern, the concerns of the State Affairs Committee, the concerns of the council, the concerns of everybody in trying to decide when it's public, when it's private. I would point out, for anyone who's confused about allegations or anything like that, many of you received in your mailbox this morning a very bizarre document which made very wild allegations about a vast number of people. And I don't see any reason why, if the commission receives a document like that, they should be required to publicize it, for example. And as you move from that continuum through the examples which were given on the speakerphone to real misconduct, somewhere you need to draw your line as to when it goes public. The commission has given examples as to the kinds of things that it would deal with informally and privately, and has also, I'm sure, can give examples of the things that it would feel need to be taken to a public process, such as repeated violations of some of the examples they just gave. I wish to extend to you personally the courtesy of discussing this matter, because we would like to get a product out of this committee that has broad support. This is an important group. They need to have their rules clearly defined, and we don't want to put them in a position where they either, one, avoid cases because they're afraid that if they bring it up, they will slander a judge who should not be criticized because he hasn't really done anything. Likewise, we don't want to make the process so closed that people can get away with things they shouldn't get away with. So we're trying to strike that balance. In order to do so, as soon as everybody gets a chance to air their views, Mr. Gruenberg will explain the proposal of the House Judiciary Committee chairman. And then Mr. Martin and yourself and other members of the committee will have a chance to critique that. But I just want to get the cards on the table here. You made some changes in state affairs. You, I think, have heard where they'd like to back away a bit from those changes, and we would appreciate your comments.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. the state affairs changes, the real focus is that under the proposal, the proposed committee substitute in the judiciary committee substitute, complaints would be confidential until the commission voted to bring charges, formal charges. Under the state affairs version, complaints are confidential until the first meeting of the commission, at which time, if the commission doesn't vote to make them confidential, they become public.
Automatically.
If they don't vote to make them confidential, they become public. So, instead of having the burden being on, in other words, the presumption after the first meeting is for openness, rather than the presumption being for being closed after the first meeting. All things are confidential until the commission meets, and at that time they'll have to take an affirmative act to make something confidential. And we just felt, in state affairs, that wasn't very much to ask. Because there seems to be such a bias in favor of keeping everything confidential, that at least just forcing them to vote to make it confidential, they're going to start to realize it will bring it home to them that they're doing this. They can still do that. There's no problem. It just takes a vote to do that.
I have a question, if I may. In both versions, the judiciary proposal, which I hope you'll forgive me, Terry, isn't really before us, but since Dave mentioned it, the judiciary proposal and the state affairs bill both include the sentence that the hearing is public. Now, how can you have a public hearing with the proceedings being confidential anyway, no matter how you solve this question. It seems to me that the hearing is essentially private, and the results under, I guess you'd say, our proposal become public, and under theirs stay private. I'd like to get that explained. Mr. Grunberg.
Yeah. The hearing is not the first step. The first step is at a meeting of the commission.
Oh, my error. Okay, I see. Okay.
And that's when the staff report on the allegation is given to the commission. And at that time, the commission will vote on whether to find probable cause and issue a complaint against
the judge. Could you cite me the line in the state affairs bill that addresses this particular
I'm not sure point. It's in the bill because they don't amend every section of this act. This only deals with selected sections.
The state affairs committee has made something public. Where is that in the bill?
Oh, I see.
It's page 3. Lines 2 through 7.
Andy, why don't you come on up here so that Marla can hear what you're saying. Page 3, lines 2 through 7.
Okay. And in the... is that correct, Marla?
That's correct.
I guess what I'm going to do is this is, I'm not bringing this CS before us for discussion as a CS, but it does include language, and so I want to recognize the fact that there is a draft committee substitute in the file for reference of members. Where on that draft is the equivalent language, please?
Andy?
Looks like section... 6, is that it?
No, again, it would be section 4.
Section 4?
Section 4.
Page 3 of the bill, lines 10 through 17.
Well,
the confidential portion is 15 through 18, lines 15 through 18.
Yeah, but that's not what I'm asking. It says, after the commission has had an opportunity to vote on the issue, all proceedings, records, files, etc. are public unless they vote to make it private. That's in state affairs. Now, so you're saying that that corresponds to what in this other bill? I don't see anything like that.
That's not in the judiciary version bill. What the judiciary bill says, Mr. Chairman, is page 3, lines 14 through 17, just says, proceedings and records that occur before the commission holds a public hearing on an allegation are confidential.
I see. All right, now, I hear you.
The hearing doesn't happen until formal charges are decided to be brought by the commission.
Okay, that was Mr. Donnelly. That's clear. Now, Marla, what is your objection? What would your objection be if we took this judiciary version and instead of where it says are confidential?
What page and line?
Page 3, line 16 of this judiciary language that we have for discussion.
It's confidential subject to the provisions of 060B.
Now, why not say that they are not confidential unless the commission votes to keep them confidential? What is the problem, in your view, with giving the commission that opportunity to make them confidential affirmatively rather than have them be automatically confidential?
Okay, I think it's basically a philosophical policy question. I can tell you that the current commission will vote on every single complaint that is filed with us and vote to keep it confidential because the commission has consistently agreed with the current statutory policy that complaints that are not proven by any investigation should not be made public because they can hurt the reputation of a judge or they can in some way hurt the person who's complaining to us. Those are the two public policy concerns for the reason for confidentiality before an investigation is taken place.
So I just want to see if I can get from you something that goes beyond the matter of convenience.
No, I'm saying I think it's a policy matter. It's that both the judge and the complainant deserve clear policy protection that the complaint before us that has not been substantiated by an investigation should remain confidential until an investigation has been completed.
Do I understand correctly that without that protection, if I am before a judge accused of a crime and I make a complaint about that judge, and the commission decides the complaint has no merit, that if it's public, the judge must become aware of the fact that I'm complaining about him and I risk prejudicing my case?
Yes, correct.
Are you sure?
I don't understand.
Am I sure?
Yes, are you sure I'm correct?
I think that's a possibility.
Well, which is it? Or is it a possibility or is it correct? I mean, I'll say it again. Mr. Donnelly wasn't sure of my question. Let me repeat it. I am in court charged with a crime. I think the judge is guilty of malfeasance. I go to you and I make a charge against that judge, and you determine that although I'm well-intentioned, I'm wrong. The judge wasn't in Minnesota on that day. Now, if your records are required to be public, the judge then must find out that I have made a complaint against him while my case is pending in court, and I risk prejudicing that judge against me. Is that correct or is that incorrect?
There's a procedural gap.
I want to hear what she says. You can correct the record.
If it becomes public, then yes, the judge is a member of the public and would know about it just like any other member of the public. I'm not concerned about judges acting in a retaliatory way against a complainant.
No.
But complainants, on the other hand, often file complaints with us that are frivolous and then inform the judges on their own, hoping that it gives the judge reason to recuse himself from their case.
Well,
it just opens the process up to a lot of possible game playing and that have nothing to do with the merits of the complaints themselves, and without reason make things public that can hurt the reputation of a good judge, or when I say may harm the complainant, there may be very personal things in their complaint that they just don't want the public to know about until there's a point where it's really necessary.
Well, I think judges are human beings and are subject to spite. But be that as it may, Mr. Dama.
Sorry, I interrupted, Mr. Chairman.
No, sir. Please proceed. You say
the procedural gap was defendant in a trial. I file a complaint against the judge in a trial for something that I improper conduct. That complaint remains confidential under the committee of the State Affairs Committee substitute until the commission meets. At that time, when the commission meets by a majority of vote, they can vote to keep it confidential. Or if a majority fails to desire to keep it confidential, it can become public. So that's the procedural step that's missing there. If it becomes public, then it's public. If they think there's some prejudicial aspect, which clearly if there's an ongoing litigation, the majority of them can vote to keep it confidential until they determine at a later time whether or not they want to bring a formal charge on it. If they determine they don't want to bring a formal charge, then it's never made.
Okay, now arguments or comments. Mr. Gruenberg first.
Yeah. To answer the chairman's original question, to really understand this process, it is necessary to understand the rules of judicial conduct, the code of judicial conduct. It used to be called the canons of ethics, but the judicial canons of ethics. And this gets back to the comment that the chair made a few minutes ago on that thing that we got stuck in our boxes this afternoon. Judges operate in a different world than the rest of us. They are not politicians, although they live in a political world. They are prohibited, and it's unethical. It is an actual violation of their canons of ethics for them to take the offensive in a political campaign, even when their own seat is at stake. They can't do anything except after the campaign, official campaign starts, if there's an allegation against them, they can then rebut it. But they can't do anything to deal with arguments and innuendos and anything like this. And judges are very vulnerable because they face an arena on a daily basis. And it's an arena where, by definition, one party's going to win and one party's going to lose in most cases. Now, I'm not talking about the cases that settle, but the cases that actually are tried. they're dealing in many cases with very unreasonable parties who often have families and friends who are very much caught up in the action, although they're not in front of the judge. And it's very much of a trial by combat, not too dissimilar from the old dunking days, when you were guilty. If you lived, you were guilty, and if you died, you were innocent. I mean, that's overstating it. But the point is that the judge, in many ways, is somewhat like the Speaker of the House. They can simply sit there and observe the argument, but they can't participate. And then they ultimately render a decision, and one side loses. As a result, judges are very, very prone to getting complaints. And frankly, the people who are the most crazy and the most dangerous are the most likely to complain the loudest and with the least facts. What we're saying here, what the law has said, and this act has been on the books for a long time. We're dealing with statutes that have been around, Mr. Chairman, since, I believe, Alaska became a state. Isn't that right, Marla?
Well, actually, it's 1968.
Since 1968. And, Mr. Chairman, what we're saying here, simply, is that in a criminal situation, and what we're really talking about is a discipline against a judge that may very well destroy the judge's career, potentially, that the judge should be given the same right you give the most common criminal. When a district attorney or a municipal attorney, anybody, investigates a complaint, let's say your complaint, you own a dog, and the question is whether your dog bit your neighbor, you actually would go to the police and there'd be a confidential investigation at that point.
Can I ask just a clarification there?
Yeah.
I just passed a note to Hayden along those lines. You have the charge, the indictment. You have the charge, the grand jury process, the indictment. And the investigation. Well, the charge itself is generally public, is it not?
No. May I explain?
Please.
The situation from our point of view today, it's irrelevant whether you go through the concept of an indictment or you get just a criminal complaint or a citation. Until you're actually charged, and if it's a dog bite situation, you would be charged formally with a citation. That's the lowest level thing. If it's a criminal complaint where they don't indict, like for a misdemeanor, or sometimes they do for a felony, then it's at that point that the district attorney signs the document and has found that there is probable cause. Or if it's an indictment, the grand jury finds there is probable cause. That's the point it becomes public. Actually, you can be charged in a situation of misdemeanor, and you can ask for a probable cause hearing. It's called a preliminary inquiry. But the point is, at that point, the charge has been brought. That's when it becomes public. And it's either in a secret indictment that's made public and published, or it's in the complaint that's actually made public, or it's in a citation that's actually public. That's when the official charge is brought. And every common, ordinary, Mr. Chairman, every garden variety criminal is confidential until that point. And all we're saying here is that that should be the same point for a judge. And if the evidence is at a Mexican standoff, and there's a case that discusses the term Mexican standoff, if the evidence is evenly balanced, and the commission doesn't, if the commission believes there's cause to go through, and the standard for probable cause is the following, that there must be sufficient evidence to support a judgment of conviction. There must be sufficient evidence here, Mr. Chairman, that would support, on its face, unrebutted, the charge. It's an ex parte thing. At that point, as a matter of law, this becomes public.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Max. Now,
and I'm finished.
Now, what you're saying is very compelling, very clear, and I think will be very important on the floor and in your discussions with state affairs members. But let me throw in the other type of example, where a police officer arrests you
because he sees you near the scene of an event.
Okay.
And he says, gee, I'm looking around and you're running away from that event, or even walking away. I mean, I'd like to limit the evidence here. That arrest shows up in the police blotter.
It's confidential by law.
You mean when someone is picked up in Haines and they go down on the police blotter there, that doesn't show up in the newspaper, only the DWI arrest or something where there's clearly probable cause and they make a distinction when they...
I don't know what happens in Haines, but I...
Well, or Juneau or Anchorage.
In Anchorage, the arrest, a reporter may be there and see the arrest.
No, I mean where it's given out by the police department. I'm sort of following your line of thinking. I want to make sure, I agree with the difference between the judge and the citizen with regard to the fact that the judge is subject to slander by anybody who doesn't like his judgments, and you want to protect him from unnecessary and improper ridicule. At the same time, if he gets, you know, picked up by...
The policeman don't know he's a judge.
You know? Gets picked up for a drunk and disorderly or something. That's that one incident of behavior that's not appropriate.
We had that not too long.
Isn't that going to be public information when the officer picks him up? So how does that relate to this is what I need to understand.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not certain how the newspaper gets that information. But generally, it may be that they have somebody who covers the police place, and they're down there or something, but police reports, accident reports and police reports are by statute confidential.
Can you comment at all on this little situation that we're building here, which is trying to keep some equal protection issues clear, that if a person is accused of one of these things and it's a citizen, it's just as damaging to a citizen to be reported in the press of being picked up drunk and disorderly as it is a judge. I mean, for me, for example, here I've got a position of public trust. I don't have any such protection. So how do you relate, and Marla, maybe after Jan, you'll have a comment, how do you relate that situation to this argument? Is there a relationship? What is it? What conclusions do you draw?
I'm not sure that I can relate it very well, and I want to just make clear right now that my comments are just mine and not those of the court. The court has given me very specific and limited ability to comment on the bill. It seemed to me that arrest records, at least in the courthouse, anybody can look at.
Would you note that for the record, please, that these comments are personal comments and not representative of the court system? Go ahead, please.
Arrest records are there for anyone to come and look at in the courthouse. A difference between a judge being arrested and a citizen being arrested, there is none. It's just what happened in Anchorage not too long ago. It's damaging no matter what. I think the difference from the Conduct Commission is there needs to be some initial screening, because an arrest should be made with probable cause. I mean, if a police officer doesn't have probable cause, up until recently, he or she could have been liable for false arrest, and often is. That's one avenue a person would have against a false arrest.
I hate to interrupt, but what do you mean until recently? Has the Supreme Court taken that away from us too now?
Well, there are certain immunities, municipal immunities, and...
You're talking about the Busby case.
Right. That's state court immunities given to peace officers.
All right, I don't want to distract from the record. I'm sorry. I'll fight that another day.
Okay.
Go right ahead,
but
please.
I'm just saying there are some immunities now that may prohibit that type of action being brought. But in a conduct situation, there's very little recourse for a judge, and that's why there needs to be some threshold probable cause standard before these things are made public. And this is not what the court asked me to talk about.
Jan, could I ask you, is this the time to ask you what the court did ask you to speak about?
Sure, I'd be happy.
Or should we wait until we finish this? If it's germane, I'd like to hear it now, if not later. Forgive me, Mr. Martin.
I think we're in agreement here. I think the major difference here is we're talking about citizens making allegations against judges and complaints and filing them, whereas a officer of the law who don't know that guy from beans, that I got a title or she got a title or what, arrested someone for breaking the law as they see it, drunk driving, assault, whatever it may be. And I think there's two major things there, in the sense that he or she performing upholding the law has the responsibility of making a formal report, which is public. Now, if the judge says I wasn't drunk, then he has to go to court and defend himself just like you and I.
Terry, let me ask you, because
it's not an allegation.
Quite honestly, I've appreciated where you've taken the discussion in the early parts of this meeting, and do I understand you? I don't want to hold you to it at this point if you're not ready, but do I understand you to be saying that having thought about this difference of opinion as to when we should go for public, that you tend to support more confidentiality at the early stage, and then once they have probable cause, go public with it?
Yeah, after Representative Donnelly explained it, and I think Max, I was more comfortable saying yes, but I still feel there's a gate I'm not sure. When a person makes an allegation to the commission, I think both of them say it's confidential up until the point where the commission votes on it. Then you have a kind of when is our meeting open and when is it closed? Can they say complaint number one needs to be brought and kept under confidentiality until we vote on it? Complaint number two, so that whoever, you know, we formally open a meeting publicly, and then we close it according to those sanctions of confidentiality. And I'm not sure at that time if we had a period.
May I suggest that after we get the statement from Ms. Strandberg, I don't think we need her anymore anyway. After we get the statement from Ms. Strandberg, then we open up that discussion of committee procedures and try to get that clarified. Okay. Marla, can you still hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, this seems to be moving in the direction that you want. Before we take Jan's comment, is there anything you feel that you need to put on the record?
Yes, I do. Actually, I'm feeling a very awkward position in defending the closed beginning part of the process. This bill was introduced originally at the request of the commission to open up a process that's currently closed, and that is the formal hearing process. So I initially started out testifying on this legislation with taking the advocacy approach that we're trying to open things up, and we think this is a very good public policy thing to open up the formal proceedings. I still very much feel that way, and I just wanted to make the statement that I'm uncomfortable now being in the position of advocating the closed portion. I think the real substance of the judiciary bill as it was originally introduced is to open up the formal hearing process that currently is closed, and that's something the commission very much wants to do. And I'd much rather phrase my testimony in a very positive way, because that really is the intention of the bill that was originally introduced.
Well, I very much appreciate your recalling the committee's attention to that fact. That is, of course, why we introduced the bill. What I'd like to ask you to do, if you would be to submit, maybe you could fax it to 463-5661, one paragraph that summarizes the, and you may speak for us on this because we drafted the bill at your request and to your specifications. If you would be so kind as to provide the committee with one paragraph, which we will put at the beginning of this hearing's record and yesterday's hearing record, and we'll repeat it in the minutes, and staff can put in a little footnote that the committee decided that an introductory comment was required here to clarify the minutes. And we will put that at the beginning of both days' hearing record for anyone who reads this to understand what the intent of this bill is, the intent of the committee is, and taking note of the fact that subsequent discussion is dealing with technicalities between versions. Because I believe that when we argue this on the floor, that is going to be of paramount importance, and I'm grateful that you brought it back to us. So if you'd submit that to us, we'll have Sheila get that in the record for you, and you're absolutely right. Jan, what does the court system wish you to say to us, ma'am?
Well, even before the court system, I'd like to just tell you a brief background about public disclosure in the other states, unless you already know how the other
anything
states
anything you think it. Is important for the record?
No, I don't know.
In 23 states, public disclosure is upon the filing of formal charges and formal hearings, as the Judicial Conduct Commission original bill, and I believe the working draft of the CS has done. In 18 states, public disclosure is upon the commission's recommendation of discipline or removal to the state Supreme Court. In 9 states, is there public disclosure only after the state Supreme Court orders public discipline or removal. So.
And in those states, are the complaints made public automatically?
That's correct. So just for background information.
Well, that's very useful. Thank you.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
The Supreme Court has authorized me to make just very limited remarks about these bills. First, a majority of the court endorses the adoption of the American Bar Association standards, which do open the formal proceedings to the public. And if you would like, I could read the ABA's rationale.
I'm sorry, Jen. Would you repeat what you just said?
Jen, my interruption was to suggest that Mr. Gruenberg consult with you prior to this bill moving to the out of the Rules Committee to make sure that all of this very interesting and compelling information is available to members.
I would appreciate it if you would put your testimony in writing.
I'd be happy to. In fact, I basically have, although...
I'd like to hear it, though, because...
Yes, I want to hear it, too.
Okay. If you would like, I could... What I had said is the majority of the court supports the American Bar Association standards on discipline, which endorses opening formal hearings to the public. If you would like, I could read the ABA rationale for it, or we could do it at another time.
May I ask a question here?
Mr. Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Strandberg, did the ABA say when?
Yes.
When?
After the filing of the formal charges.
I would like that. And I would like you to append that to your testimony.
And if the rationale isn't too long, I'd like to get a summary of it.
Yes.
Why don't you just paraphrase a short summary for our benefit?
All right. Essentially, it says in the same reasons that Marla has given about the confidentiality in the initial stages. The judge has an interest to protect his or her reputation from unfounded charges, and the complainants have interest in being protected from possible recrimination, and the commission itself has interest in having unfettered investigatory power. The responsibility of the commission is to protect the reputation of the judge and the integrity of the judicial process from frivolous or unfounded charges, and to be able to fully investigate charges of misconduct with the complete cooperation of others. After the commission determines there's probable cause and formal charges have been filed, then the policy emphasis shifts from confidentiality to the public's right to know. Once the finding of probable cause has been made, there is no longer a danger that the charges are frivolous. It's no longer necessary to protect the identity of the witnesses, since the judge is entitled to that information during discovery. Furthermore, evidence received at the public hearing is subject to public inspection as in any other court proceeding. And then it closes with, the integrity of the judicial system is better protected by an open public hearing than by a closed hearing that may raise questions concerning the credibility of the proceeding. This is particularly true in those instances where the conduct is publicly known and the commission proceedings are subject to rumor and speculation. That's the rationale for the ABA standards. If I could just go on, the court does have 3 concerns about the bills.
Just on the last point, I would like to specifically request that you arrange a meeting with Representative Donnelly and try to go through this in some detail with him. He's an attorney. I'm sure he can appreciate some of the things you've said.
I would be happy to.
It would help us. Please go ahead.
The first concern is that retired judges should come within the commission's jurisdiction only if they're acting in their judicial capacity as judge pro tem.
This relates to the bill. Oh, I see. Now, so this is an additional section you're recommending?
Well, this is just comments or amendments to any of the bills. None of the bills take care of that problem.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you to draft your comments in form of amendments and provide them to the committee at your earliest possible convenience. We would like to get this bill out of committee. It's a House bill, and it's growing in size, which worries me a little. Please proceed.
I'd be glad to do that immediately as well. The court also would recommend...
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt you again. If you take a look at the last page of the judiciary proposal, not yet a CS before us, but language work. Line 2, do you want to maybe suggest that you just add some language after the phrase retired?
Exactly. Or who is retired and serving pro tem. I think that would take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's number one.
Well, this next recommendation, we realize that the commission does not agree with the Supreme Court on. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court, in inquiry concerning a judge, the case that was passed out to you in 1988, held that the commission under the Constitution only has authority to recommend discipline, not to impose it. And so the Supreme Court would like the bill to reflect that, which would mean deleting public or private reprimand and private admonishment.
Noted.
Does someone else do it, or does the court would do it?
The court believes that only the court has the authority to do all of those things under the Constitution.
Mr. Gruenberg?
Yes, this is very important, and I would like, if we can, to digress for a minute, Mr. Gruenberg. Ms. Greenstein, can you hear Ms. Strandberg?
Barely, but I did meet with Ms. Strandberg here yesterday, so I'm familiar with the court's position on the bill.
You're welcome to come on up.
Yeah, that'd be better, Jim. Why don't you sit over here and then you can close
your I'm almost finished.
Ms. Greenstein, what Ms. Strandberg said, and Ms. Strandberg, I would just ask, did you hear the last point of Ms. Strandberg about the private admonishment or reprimand? Did you hear that testimony just a second?
If she included the word admonishment, that would be new to me. I had thought that the court's position was public or private reprimand were no longer within the authority of the commission.
What I am concerned about, Mr. Chairman, and I would ask Ms. Strandberg, I would ask Ms. Strandberg and Ms. Greenstein to carefully examine, and I'll call it the Gruenberg proposed bill here, and also the State Affairs CS, to ensure that section of the bill, whatever page and line you ladies are talking about, is constitutional. I don't want to do something that's unconstitutional. I'd ask the two of you to work with Mr. Hemingway to ensure that what we do is constitutional. And if there is a question and you can't resolve it, then the members of the committee can help you. Is that agreeable with both of you?
That's fine.
Yes, I would think that we'd be able to work out. The commission did not take a position on adjusting that language because they didn't want to get in the business of interpreting a Supreme Court decision. But with Ms. Strandberg's help, I'm sure we could work it out.
Just a second, though. There's something wrong here. First of all, reprimand is not in the bill, so that's not an issue, right? There's no reprimand involved here. That was stricken out of the law by this bill, was it not? Marla?
It stays in the bill.
Where is that?
As it's currently drafted. It's on the original House Bill 268. It's on page 2, line 19.
I understand. Thank you very much. Now I get it. I get it.
But for the rest of us.
But this is existing law. Well,
the law is currently on the books with that language in it. The Supreme Court came out with a decision that said that the commission does not have the authority to issue those sanctions on its own.
But it will now.
Well, what is the commission's position on that ruling?
The commission did not personally agree with that ruling, but it is the law of the state because the Supreme Court came down with it. So until the court revisits that particular issue or the Constitution gets amended, since it was based on the state constitutional provision, that is the understanding the commission has right now is that it does not have that authority.
Well, then, do you have an objection to striking it from the statutes, or do you want to leave it in there and work on a constitutional amendment? What is the position of the commission?
Well, the commission basically decided to, I think after consulting with you last year, just decided not to make any adjustments on its own, not to initiate any adjustments to that language in the statute. That the commission felt it could be left up to the reviser of statute to make those adjustments if that was necessary, but the commission didn't want to affirmatively do that. It certainly would be appropriate to conform the statute to the current state of the law. So I'm basically being noncommittal about it.
Mr. Gruenberg, when we talked about this last year, we were talking...
Sorry, Max, please proceed.
We were talking about whether, number one, a bill would be introduced, and number two, whether a constitutional amendment would be introduced to allow this. We didn't take it out because we were thinking that the commission would maybe want to introduce a constitutional amendment. The commission decided not to do a constitutional amendment this year. Therefore, unless we're going to do a constitutional amendment, it should come out because it's unconstitutional, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, now, I've noted that. Now, I'd like to ask Ms. Strandberg, who has researched this thing in other states, is this a unique constitutional provision, to the best of your knowledge? Do other states provide for the reprimand? What's the story there?
I can't give you a countdown on all states. I've read this case, and I can tell you that the California Constitution does permit informal admonishments, but nothing else. And that's as far as I can go, but I would be happy to do some research for you to let you know.
Ms. Greenstone, do you have a comment on that? Other states?
Yes, it varies from state to state. In general, there are various formats. Sometimes it's by court rule, sometimes by constitution, and sometimes the commission is granted this power by statute. The Supreme Court looked to the fact that the Alaska state constitution was based on the California constitution, therefore looked to California as the state to interpret the law in this respect. It certainly was appropriate, but there are other states that take other alternative approaches.
I'd like to respectfully suggest to the committee to consider the idea of just leaving it alone and giving the commission another legislative session to determine whether it wants to move on a constitutional amendment here. Since we're not taking any affirmative action, I'd kind of like to just ignore it. Mr. Morton?
Except for one point, I think we should evaluate it because it's going to be two more years before they can do anything about it.
Right.
But under Section 8 on Article 4 of the Constitution, with our judicial council, I thought that we had a unique constitution in the sense that we're the only ones that clearly establishes a judicial council. I remember the meetings of the 55-56 convention making that clear.
Ms. Greenstein, do you want to comment on that for Mr. Martin?
Certainly, that is correct as far as the Judicial Council. The Commission on Judicial Conduct was created by amendment to the Constitution as a separate agency from the Judicial Council. The Commission on Judicial Conduct was added in 1968 and was based on a movement that was happening across the country was to create these judicial disciplinary bodies. The Commission on Judicial Conduct is a very similar agency to those existing in the other 49 states.
Mr. Martin?
Yeah. What I'm thinking of is that the conduct of the Supreme Court and to make it unique within itself was one of the things different in our Constitution at the Constitutional Convention so that it would be non-political. Part of the reason why they didn't want judges elected and so on. So therefore, to admonish itself and to correct itself just like a professional group of doctors was constitutionally protected. I was wrong on the council. I thought the council was at that same time. But it just seemed to me that they deliberately, in our constitutional convention, made the Supreme Court or the judicial system pretty well protected from the public. And so it has no choice but to admonish itself, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Okay, well, could you give us your third point, please, Ms. Strandberg?
Yes, and it was on the standard we were talking about earlier, and that is a probable cause standard. The entire court would like to see a probable cause standard in statute, and that it be based on the same standard that a grand jury issues, which is all of the evidence taken together would warrant, in this case, a sanction to a judge.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Greenberg?
I would ask that you draft the language in the thing. Ms. Greenstein, is that, would that be, I assume that would be okay with the commission to include that?
Well,
This time, as I mentioned to Mr. Dranberg, it might be just as appropriate for commission rule. I don't think it matters either way, whether it's in the statute or commission rule.
It matters to this representative. I sort of take, I'm not sure I have a, I'm not sure I'm ready to suggest that that the same kind of, I mean, this is not like a criminal standard here where somebody is going to be, you know, held over for indictment. This is where we're passing on potentially the ethics of a judge, and I don't want some judge going to court and saying, oh, well, yes, but this or but that. These are people who put people in jail by whatever happens to float through their mind at the moment, and I think they must be held to an extraordinarily higher standard of conduct than you or I, even as legislators, who have to put our position to a vote of other people. A Supreme Court judge can kill you, practically. I mean, not in this state, but damn close. And I don't want any loopholes being played in this game, so I'm very conservative about this point. I'm not sure I'm ready to deal with that in this bill, which is just opening up procedures. And the bill is growing and growing and growing. If it grows too far, it could just die in the other body, and I'm not sure I'm ready for that. Mr. Groomer.
Just one point here. Looking at this in the real world, and I don't want to bring this to a vote or anything at this point. For the commission to act, the commission of necessity will use a standard, always has, must. Anytime one makes a decision, one bases it upon a standard, unless it's totally arbitrary, and that's the worst of all possible worlds. So the way the commission as a group of nine people always has worked is with a standard. The only questions before us are two. Number one, what should the standard be? I think it is absolutely unacceptable to have no standard even implied. That's totally arbitrary. So the first question...
As you point out, Mr. Gruber, that isn't the case. They'll be able to speak to their standards if asked, I'm sure.
Well, but that's right. There is a standard. The question is, what should it be?
Right.
And the second question is, who should enact it?
Right.
Should it be the legislature or the commission?
Right.
And for exactly the reasons you have expressed, Mr. Chairman,
right,
I think you should at least respectfully consider, that number one, there should be a standard established. Number two, it should be expressly stated. And number three, I think it's too important to leave to another body. I think this legislature should establish it. And now, I don't know if it's any more.
Well, I guess my position on that would be that this bill is a judiciary bill, and it's still in the House Judiciary Committee. And I would suggest that we make this bill as short as possible. In fact, Mr. Groomberg, I would respectfully urge you to work with, you know, this is your draft. I would urge you to strive to make this draft as short as possible so that the issue of opening up these meetings can be handled expeditiously and successfully. Given the fact that this bill is in its first committee of referral, we could have a second bill before us.
The reason it was delayed was at my request. It was not...
What I'm driving at is I would suggest that we do it in a separate bill. I have no objection to considering the subject, but I think if we start getting into the standards of how the commission deals with a case, apart from the procedures of opening or closing the meetings, we're going to compound the issues. It's just my opinion. If there's consensus available between the Supreme Court and the Commission on what those standards should be and how they should be codified, I'm willing to support using this committee for that purpose. But if there's going to be a debate about it, there isn't any debate about this, and I think we need to shoot it through and be cognizant of political realities here. That's just my feeling, not necessarily a position. But
we don't need to address that today.
Okay, well, we understand that we're going to get a written amendment regarding the retired judges. We understand that we have yet to make a final decision, but we seem to be leaning towards giving a bit more time on the constitutional amendment idea, and we are undecided as to whether or not there's probable cause for acting on the probable cause issue.
but you're going to provide us with a comment, Ms. Greenstein, and a comment, Ms. Strandberg, which you'll develop together so that we'll understand your joint and severable. Felix, I'm learning all these great words. Opinions on the matter. Mr. Martin, and then maybe we can get back to this bill, which seems to be wrapping up in a manner of speaking.
Yeah, on the bill, I think you're right, Mr. Chairman, that as this is perceived, I think the public is going to be a big plus for the legislature to give the public a sense of confidence that these meetings are being open, because over the years we've had so many complaints and allegations, and I, for one, just don't know what to say about it. But this is going to give them a big sense of, well, fresh air. And certainly it'll get a burden off the commission's back that they don't deserve having. I would like to also emphasize what Representative Bloomberg has mentioned, the standard, but I would like to keep them separate. Hopefully that we would get them through. But this one here, we're down to the 60-day mark. And the sooner we can get this over to them, then let's work on the standards, but I'd like to at least do this much.
I agree, and I'd like to backtrack a little bit. I don't mean to imply that, you know, the judges should be held up for some sort of extraordinary standard or scrutiny, and I do think that standards must be applied, and they must be available for review. But I share Mr. Martin's feeling on this. I think maybe one way to get a sense of direction here would be, unless there's further comment on any of these issues, which seem to be really kind of nicely laid out in my view, the time is now for Mr. Gruenberg to take us through this judiciary CS so we can see what we are proposing to have before us.
Yeah, and Ms. Greenstein and Ms. Strandberg, correct me if I'm wrong, but basically the first thing it does is, let us start from
just go section by section and try to go through it quickly.
Okay. Number one, and Andy, I'm going to ask you to help me with this. Number one does not appear in the previous versions. And the first section is a technical amendment in the election code. And this, on line 19, is simply a conforming amendment, eliminating a little reference here. So it just conforms to the rest of the bill. Section 2.
This one, I just tell you, on the election code, is that time all right? Because I know when we fill out our election pamphlet, I thought they asked for a date in July. They asked very early for written things, sections that we're going to fill.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Herbert?
We can't deal with the August 7 date in this bill without changing the title. That relates to the Judicial Council, not the Commission.
So this is existing law anyway, Terry.
Okay. Yeah.
The only change in section one is the clerical change on line 19.
Conforming amendment.
Yes, sir, just to indicate that there are those sections later on.
Section two is a new section, and Ms. Greenstein, why don't you tell us what you did in section two?
Okay, basically, this was a reflection of Representative Donnelly's concern that there was the potential for the judge and lawyer members of the commission to meet without any public members participating, just because they're a majority of judges and lawyers on the commission, which is accurate. What this provision would do is it requires a quorum to consist of at least one of those three groups that are represented on the commission, so that before we have a meeting, we have to have at least one member of each of those groups present at the meeting. And hopefully that would address that concern. So it, in other words, ensures that a public member will be at every meeting of the commission. I should mention parenthetically that it hasn't been a problem, and to the best of my knowledge, we've always had a representative group, but this ensures that.
Mr. Hemingway has a comment on this section. Mr. Jennings?
Actually, this goes back to the preceding section. It's something that I just thought of now as I'm looking at it.
Can you hear Andy speak up?
Yeah. And on that first section, as I said, that was put in by the reviser, Ledge Drafting just did that because the bills, the subsections of 011D were renumbered in the bill, so they simply took out the reference to the subsections in order to clarify, so there wouldn't be any conflict there. That's conforming technical amendment. But I think there is a substantive question that comes to mind in light of the decision by the Supreme Court in In Re Inquiry of the Judge. Under prior law, the commission itself had the authority to issue these public sanctions and admonishments and whatever. And that information would have been included in the election brochure. The Supreme Court is now saying you cannot do that. So the only thing that will be in the election brochure will be the reprimand, censure, or suspension by the Supreme Court. In other words, there is nothing in the nature of a public reprimand, public censure, or suspension that can be done under 2230.011. It can only be recommended to the Supreme Court. So I think you have two questions. One, do we want to put in there that we want to change that so that the election brochure includes the sanction handed out by the Supreme Court, or do you want to change it to say that it includes the recommendations for sanctions made by the Judicial Conduct Commission? So I think on reevaluation here, I think we've got a fairly significant policy decision to make with respect to that first section.
I appreciate your
comment. If I may, I really don't think that it's necessary. If I'm reading this correctly, subsection D is after the hearing may do these things or recommend to the Supreme Court. That part of the statute that refers to public censure or suspension was always true of the Supreme Court. The only thing that has been changed by the Supreme Court decision was public reprimand was added to that list. And for whatever reason, the drafters of the initial legislation decided to refer to the statutory source rather than the Constitution. I agree with Andy that the constitutional reference would have been more appropriate, but since it referred to things that the Supreme Court could only do from the beginning, I don't see that the Supreme Court decision changed that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I thought that we changed the law a couple of years ago that did allow, and that's a misunderstanding, Andy, public reprimand to be in the election pamphlet.
That was your amendment?
It was on your bill, what I'm thinking.
Right, but that's the question here, Representative Martin, is simply whether or not it's the Judicial Conduct Commission's recommendation or the fact that the Supreme Court actually imposed the sanction. And what Marla is saying is that it's not that all along this statute has been read to mean not the Judicial Conduct Commission's recommendation, but the action taken to actually impose a sanction.
Well, so gentlemen, I don't think it matters since it says here very specifically that these are the public reprimand.